Welcome to today's episode of Brainer on Leadership, your online home for leadership lessons and advice from both the local church and the workplace. I'm your host, Jonathan Howe, and as always, I'm joined by Tom Brainer, the president and CEO of Lifeway Christian Resources.
You know, we always get spikes on the podcast, Jonathan, when I'm not the main attraction, when we have people that are far superior to me. And I can only imagine that this time in September that there's going to be a lot of traffic, because I am honored and humbled to have Alistair Begg as our guest. The name needs very little introduction, but I got to tell you, someone who has stayed at one church for 31 years, and he came when he was 31 years old, so, you know, do the math, he's 62 years old, and one of the premier expository preachers in America and the world today. And Alistair, all I got to say is thank you for being here. We are working you one thing after another in your brief time here at Lifeway, but thank you for being here.
It's my privilege to be here, Tom.
Talk to us. And I mentioned this to you before we even started recording, that there are a significant number of listeners who are pastors and staff. They would account for about two-thirds of them. Talk to us about the tenacity or what it takes to stay at a church that long. Give us just a little bit of your background, of your long tenure.
Well, you know, part of what it takes is a long-suffering congregation.
I understand that. I've been a pastor too.
It's a dance, isn't it, between both the congregation and the pastor. So many fellows, I think, overestimate what they can accomplish in a short time and underestimate what they can accomplish over time.
Wow.
And I have had models both from the United Kingdom and then from here in America of people who had stayed in a place for a while. And I never set out to stay here for all this time. I don't know whether I should be, you know, commended for it or criticized for a lack of initiative, but here I am. And I think that what I've realized as time has gone by is that this principle of enjoying the privilege of seeing your children actually walking in the truth, of seeing lives impacted and changed in a generational way. I mean, I've got fellows on my pastoral team, and you know, I performed their baptisms. I actually dedicated them as children. I held them in my arms.
Wow. And I'm
marrying the children of the people that I married. and I think it just takes a commitment. It's a mindset. Refusing to believe that the other man's grass is always greener, especially if you live in a place like Cleveland. I mean, it's not difficult to find the allure of a Dallas or a New York or an LA.
Sure, sure.
So, yeah.
Talk to us. A lot of the pastors that listen to this podcast or come to my blog are going through challenging times. It's endemic across not only our nation, but across the world, challenging churches and challenging times. Can you share with us some of the moments that have been some more challenging times for you? Maybe not specificity, but just general or specific, whatever you want to go.
Sure. Well, you know, I came to this church thinking, first of all, that what they had written down in their doctrinal statement, they actually understood and believed.
Wow.
Yeah. And then very quickly, I realized, you know, a few of them may have done, but most of them hadn't a clue. The man who finally secured my hand in this pastoral marriage, if you like, left the church within 3 or 4 months of me getting there, because what he thought he was getting and what he got didn't match up, and so he decided to move on. That was a real blow. One of the fellows who'd been an elder and who had been actually disappointed at the fact that I had finally come, although he had shown an interest in the beginning, he hived off about 4 or 5 miles and used his own money to rent a Seventh-day Adventist church and called a pastor on his own, you know, just like 4 miles down the road to start a rival church. So
was that soon after your arrival?
Oh yeah, this is in the get-go. You know, this is
wow.
This
is over.
Yeah, this is in the climb out. You know, I mean, this is, you know, let the engines go and let's start. You know, we hadn't reached 10,000 feet, and it was all, you know, pieces were falling off the aircraft. So yeah, I know quite a lot about that, but I was so convinced that I was where I was supposed to be, that the fact that, you know, the place was full of Philistines or anything was par for the course. And so, and also I was young and I was headstrong and kind of crazy, And so it never really occurred to me to do anything else but just to take these things on one at a time. And, you know, I pushed through them. And fortunately, there were enough people there who got my heart as well as, if you like, my head, and who understood that they had somebody here who really cared. And so we weathered that. There have been storms along the way, but I would say in honesty that the things that we had to weather in the initial phase really allowed me to set out my stall, as it were, for what was going to be involved in this church, the issues concerning women's leadership and should women be in positions of this and that and the next thing. All these kind of things surfaced in the first 3 years.
Wow. Well, let's talk about one of the areas for which you are known greatly, and people listen to you from afar for your expositional, your expository preaching. Talk to us about what pastors, young pastors, can learn from you after 31 years of ministry on this whole thing of expository preaching.
Well, I think they can learn from me that they can look at me and others like me and say, with God's help, I can do that. Because it's a really very straightforward approach to things, isn't it? You know, that we take a book of the Bible and we say, this is verse one, and we study it, and we can read in English, and perhaps we can do some of the study in Hebrew and Greek. But when we come to the issue, we speak as clearly as we can and as purposefully as we can, and that God uses different gifts in different people's lives, but essentially the task is the same. You know, we spend the week preparing the food and hopefully laying it on the plate in a way that people can actually manage it, not throwing big slabs of information at them that they have to chow down and stumble on. And I think essentially it's that I, you know, one of my mantras is that the main things are the plain things, and the plain things are really the main things. And so, you know, the exhortation of Paul to Timothy not to be distracted by these things, not to chase after these things. And I think if young people were looking at me, they would see that not only had I said that, but I've also chosen to do that rather than to be drawn away into things.
Pastors who are listening will have a very practical question for you. I can almost anticipate it because I know the listeners of the podcast and the readers of the blog. They will say, tell us what you do during the week for sermon preparation. Everything from how you do it to the time you do it. They're going to eat this up.
Okay. All right. I can do that.
All right.
Well, I preach four times on a Sunday. I have three morning services that are the same, and I have an evening service.
Different message?
Different message. So I have preparation to do that is pretty demanding in the week. And I work on Mondays. So we have our pastoral team meeting on a Monday. First thing in the morning, I meet with the guy who's like my wife in ministry and has been for about 20 years. I use that terminology guardedly but purposefully.
And Jonathan, do not think about using that with me, okay? Alistair Begg can use that, but
okay. Yeah, and then once we've had some time together, the other members of the pastoral team come. We spend usually the balance of the morning together, reflecting, planning, praying, reading, and then we go on from there. The balance of a Monday is usually then for me administrative, in that there's so many things that flow through from the week. And from the weekend, from the Sunday, what about what happened here, there, and everywhere? I try on a good Monday at least to get an hour or so to myself to just start to read and think about the fact that Sunday is only a matter of 6 days away again.
Right.
It's a constant tyranny. And the feeling that, you know, the week actually goes Sunday, Monday, Sunday. That sense of pressure. Tuesday I take as a day off. That's a long-standing pattern for reasons we don't need to go into, but I take a Tuesday. And so by the time I come back on Wednesday, I've got a pretty fair understanding of where I'm going, because if I'm studying 2 Timothy at the moment, so wherever we left off, we're back. And my approach is pretty simple. I've written this down, but I stole this from an elderly minister in England years ago, a guy called Leith Samuel. And my approach is, first of all, in coming to the passage, to think myself empty. I take just a foolscap sheet of paper and scribble down on it anything at all that comes to mind. Anything that comes to mind. I don't worry about whether it should come to mind.
Sure.
But if it comes to mind, I write it down. It could be anything at all. So I end up with a big sort of scramble of material. That might not take very long because I might not be able to think of very much, depending on what the passage is. But that involves poetry, it involves notes, it involves books that I've read, novels that I've read, anything at all. I let my mind range as wide as widely as I possibly can.
Right.
From thinking myself clear, from reading myself full, I go to, no, I think myself empty, sorry, and then I read myself full.
Mm.
So then I'm dealing with whatever textual helps I have, and to read, you know, whether it's old Puritan studies on the same material that have largely been buried and I can unearth them because of my library or whatever it might be. But then I would read. And I would read for as long as I can read with the pressure of time. The next process for me is then I write myself clear. And this has been for me absolutely essential. So that the longer you go and the greater facility that one has with language, the greater the danger that you can assume, at least in my case, that because it's clear in your mind, it will be clear when you verbalize it. And I've discovered that a lot of guys are actually doing their sermon editing while they're preaching. So they say something and then they go, well, you could also say, or what I mean by that is, or perhaps we could look at, and I'm listening to him go, you just wasted 3.5 minutes of my time.
Wow.
Because that should have happened. That should have happened away somewhere else earlier in the week. By the time you get to this sentence, you should know what you're trying to say in the sentence. And for me, writing that down and looking at it, then I can see non sequiturs. I can see if I started in the past tense and moved to the present. I can see if I've changed gender in the thing, which you can very easily do, no matter how good you are, just in sort of extemporaneously verbalizing things. So I write myself clear, and then I pray myself hot, and then I preach. My line is, okay, Alistair, be yourself and forget yourself. And so I don't try to edit myself when I'm preaching. I don't assume either that people don't want to hear or that they really want to hear, because both of those are pitfalls. You know, the feeling of nobody really cares or everybody really loves this.
And what's the typical length of a sermon?
I'm trying to be really disciplined at the moment at not being longer than 35 minutes.
35.
And I'm actually, in many cases, trying to preach for 30 minutes. I mean, it's not a difficulty for me to preach for longer than that. But some of the models that I have come to appreciate more and more most recently are fellows who don't waste any language and don't waste any time. And so they're able to do a phenomenally good job in a relatively short order. And I come across these young guys whose models are people who preach for a long time. And it's just the repeat of what happened, you know, when I lived in Britain as a boy and everybody thought they could be Martin Lloyd-Jones. You know, Martin Lloyd-Jones preached for 1 hour and 10 minutes. Therefore, if I do, look what happened to him and look what happened to me.
It didn't work that way.
No, because look what happened to me was the people were leaving by droves. You know, you could hear the door banging as they went out into the corridor. So again, it's that to be that to your own self, be true.
That's good. Jonathan, you're itching.
Yeah, you mentioned in that your extensive library and the Puritans you can unearth from that. Now, we've seen a resurgence of interest in Puritan writing and theology over the last decade or two, including Spurgeon. I know you're one of the big Spurgeon scholars in the world. Why do you think that we've seen this resurgence, and how has it been beneficial to the church, you know, in modern days?
Well, actually, one of the reasons we've seen it is because of Martin Lloyd-Jones and because of Ian Murray and because of Banner of Truth.
Yeah.
I mean, back in the '60s, when they began Banner of Truth, Lloyd-Jones's design and desire was to unearth a lot of that material that had just been lost. And Banner of Truth were at the forefront of that, at least in the United Kingdom. I don't know about here in the States. And so that, I think, was the start of it. I mean, my friend John MacArthur, when I met him in 1979, he had just discovered Martin Lloyd-Jones on the Sermon on the Mount. Mm-hmm. And that was a revolutionary book for him. And he'd have to tell you why. But that's, if you think about that, that's 79.
Yeah.
And as you say, the change is dramatic. I think it's because there was an agenda on the part of some people to say this is good material and people should have it.
Yeah.
And at the same time, a reaction on the part of people to a kind of pablum of writing of stuff that really was, when you got down to it, there wasn't really very much there. And so they were looking for something a little more substantial. And they found that in that. The flip side of course, is the danger of, you know, very contemporary young men, you know, just divulging big slabs of, you know, Puritan material, and saying things like, well, Jonathan Edwards did it this way, you know. Yeah, yeah. But you're not Jonathan Edwards, you know. It's kind of like, I knew Jonathan Edwards and you're not Jonathan. So, yeah.
That's a pretty famous line from American politics.
Yeah, yes, it is, yeah.
What about Spurgeon?
Well, Spurgeon, I think, you know...
He kind of never went away.
No, Spurgeon is remarkable, isn't he? Because, I don't know, I mean, Spurgeon breaks so many of the... First of all, Spurgeon is later than those guys, mm-hmm. right? So he was reading them, contextualizing them, and they flowed through the tributaries of the stream of his proclamation. But Spurgeon was such an interesting man on many fronts, you know. I mean, first of all, he's probably the first real megachurch minister. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, he broke bounds in that, you know, history records that there were times when the congregation, the Metropolitan Tabernacle, burst into seasons of prolonged and sustainable mirth. In other words, the whole congregation was laughing so long and so loud that it was questionable whether Spurgeon could even get the thing back on track again.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, so he must have been just an amazing combination, you know, of erudition and yet softness of touch on the ball, you know. And so in his lectures to his students, you get that as well. His humor is very, very impregnated in all that he does, and people respond to that as well. So I don't think he sounds sort of remote and far away in the 16th and 17th century. I mean, he was a Victorian preacher, but he realized what he was doing and to whom he was speaking. And so I think perhaps that's the big lesson from him in terms of engaging with our congregation.
What are some of the big changes after 3+ decades of ministry? What are some of the big changes? And you can contextualize it for American congregations or you can broaden it. But what have you seen take place that is different than a 31-year-old versus a 62-year-old today?
Well, for example, the thing we're doing now could never have taken place in 1983.
True.
The technology didn't exist. You know, we were on reel-to-reel that went to cassette tapes. If somebody came to you afterwards and said that Chuck Swindoll had preached on that passage as well, and they think that it would be good for me to get his tape, well, the process involved in that would be, you know, fairly protracted. But right now, while you preach, people are able to go on their phones and drag down sermons by everyone and anyone on the very passage on which you're speaking and check you, you know, in real time against that.
That's right.
That's a rather unnerving thing. And, you know, in so many ways, technology, I think, is the big, big game changer in every area, and not least of all within the framework of the church. I mean, I'm not a fan of my people not carrying their Bibles. I oppose the idea of that. I mean, I understand that it sounds Neanderthal-ish, but
as opposed to an electronic device,
yeah. and the reason more than anything else is that the electronic device, if it is capable of incoming material and if it is capable of outgoing, you know, opportunities, then, you know, sure, they've got their Bible in front of them, but they've got things that are pinging all over the place. They're saying, you know, did you pick up the eggs? Or your grandmother just went into the hospital. Or worse still, I wonder, you know, whether Argentina are going to beat, you know, the Netherlands. And all of that stuff in the average young person who's used to multitasking is going on all over the place. And that does not serve for concentration. It doesn't serve for much, I don't think. And so without being heavy-handed on it, I want to encourage people to be buying Bibles and to be reading their Bibles and to, you know, and I tell folks now, I said, no one is going to say at your father's funeral, I'm so glad he left his iPad for me. but they will be glad to have his heavily annotated Bible.
For the listeners, I want them to be aware that Dr. Begg will be preaching in chapel in an hour. And Jonathan, can you get out a quick email to all of our employees to bring a print Bible and not their iPad, okay, so that we will be a good audience for him.
Go back to my desk.
Well, no, it's the ultimate irony, though. Here we are at Lifeway Publishers. And you know, you're trying to sell me all these Bibles, and all your core guys are sitting in there. They don't even have one.
Oh my goodness, that hurts. That absolutely hurts. We got time for one more, Jonathan?
Yeah, one last question. You know, you've been in Cleveland for 31 years. Cleveland has seen some rough times in the past three decades.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, are you talking sports here or what?
Well, that too. We won't mention that, but economically. And I know there are pastors who, maybe not in large cities like you are, but in rural areas that have seen similar type of economic downturns and have just seen congregants just move because they have to have a job.
Right.
And I know you've probably experienced that at Parkside as well. How would you encourage them to, you know, kind of stay in there and keep fighting for the faith in times and in places which are economically challenged and more than likely spiritual challenged as well?
Yeah. Well, again, it comes back to something I think I said earlier. You know, the notion that there is no ideal place to serve God except the place he sets you down. And if one has that conviction, so that, you know, it's the sort of Hudson Taylor thing as well, isn't it? That God's work done in God's way will never lack God's supply. If we actually believe stuff like that, then we can hold on. If, however, we don't, then, you know, as soon as the downturn comes, we'll be tempted like the others to, you know, make a run for the hills. And I think the answer to that question falls far more in a conversation that I'd like to have with the small church's group of deacons. I'd like to speak to them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I may speak to the pastor to encourage him in certain ways, but I like to speak to those folks and say, you know, are you really taking seriously the responsibilities that you have to the sustaining of the life of your pastor, to ensuring that the pressures that are on him financially and emotionally do not actually undermine the very thing you're asking him to do?
That's a good word.
And a lot of that actually falls there, and often with the pastor's wife who, you know, is in the same grocery store as some of these other folks, and she sees what's being loaded into their carts as opposed to what's being loaded into her cart. Mm. And without that being produced by jealousy, it's there's an inevitable impact in that. And I think it really is a word to the lay people and to the way they care for their pastors.
This is rich material. I wish we could talk a lot longer, but we're at our deadline, Jonathan. So, Alistair, thank you so much. Thank you for being at Lifeway today. Thank you for letting us use you, and I hope it has not been too much use, that it'll wear you out, but I know that you're going to be in a lot of places at Lifeway today, and we're looking forward to hearing you preach the word in chapel. So thank you so much for being here.
It's been a great privilege. Thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.
Same here.
This week's podcast is brought to you by the HCSB Bible, taking into account the significant advancements in scholarship, translation theory, and contemporary English usage. The HCSB will satisfy both those new to the faith and seasoned scholars. Visit hcsb.org for more information. That'll do it for this week's episode of Rainer on Leadership. Any final closing thoughts?
I've often said on the podcast, Jonathan, that we have three major groups of listeners. We have pastors, we have other staff members from local churches, and then we have lay leaders. There have been some nuggets in this podcast with Dr. Begg that I think all of them will need to listen to it again and again. So it's been an honor, and it's good to hear everybody that is joining in to the podcast. And now that we're in the fall season, I look forward to some more opportunities to meet.
Thanks for joining us this week on Rainer on Leadership. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes and visit us online at tomrainer.com.